Our goal tonight is to bring together labor activists, anti-globalization protesters and activists, and activists from the community to talk about OCAP's proposed campaign of economic disruption in the fall. We hope to discuss the reasons why we think all of these activists need to be involved and need to become involved not only on the day and the days in October, but also organizing leading up to the fall. And we hope that tonight some people will be able to make a commitment to take on some work in building for the fall. We have three speakers here tonight. First, we're going to hear from Stefan Philippa, who's an organizer with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. Then we'll hear from Clarice, who is a member of the New Socialist Group, who is putting on the panel tonight. And she's also a co-chair of the Women's Caucus of QB 3903, which is the local at York University. And finally, we'll hear from Jaggi Singh, who is an activist and organizer based in Montreal with CLAC, the Anti-Capitalist Convergence. CLAC has officially endorsed OCAP's campaign of economic disruption in the fall, even though they are based in Montreal. So each speaker will speak for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then we'll have an opportunity for discussion after that.
Yeah. As Jackie said, my name is Stefan Philippa. I'm an organizer with OCAP. When I think about the political project that lies before us, essentially the annihilation of the Harris government, and I think about what motivates me above and beyond ideals of justice and equality and freedom is hardcore, bone-cracking, insomnia-inducing rage. Rage first at what this government, the violence and damage it shoved down our throats, has done, and second, that we've allowed them to get away with it for the last 6 years. Now the record is clear, and I'm sure every one of us here can chant it like a sadistic mantra. The murder of Dudley George, cuts to welfare and the introduction of workfare slavery, the eradication of rent control, the freezing of the minimum wage, the slashing of health care and education, the unrelenting assaults on public sector unions, the forced amalgamation of municipalities, the privatization of public services, the slashing of all affordable housing, believe it, the list goes on, the 60-hour work week, the posting of union decertification in every workplace in the province, mandatory drug and literacy testing for welfare recipients, the Walkerton tragedy, and cuts to the Ministry of the Environment, private school tax credits for the wealthy, the removal of anti-scab legislation, changes to the Labor Relations Act that would make it harder to form and keep a union, and, my favorite of all, workplace safety inspections conducted over the phone. They might as well get psychics to do it. Now, that isn't to say that our adversary hasn't been strong, or over the years we haven't put up a good, noble, honorable fight. Those are facts. But what is also a fact is that we have yet been unable to mount a massive, grassroots, political offensive campaign that will actually challenge the Harris agenda, that will actually force the Harris agenda to stop in its tracks, meet and look at our demands, or face a population in all-out revolt, a population that simply refuses to be governed by a pack of conniving, thieving, murdering criminals. Now, I think there is one reason, essentially, that such a movement has not taken shape. Now, it's not for lack of widespread hatred for this government. Of that, there can be no doubt. And it is no lack of power on our parts. There's 6 million people in this province that could actually fight the Harris government. But I think the simple fact is that after the demoralization of the days of action, no one, no group or individual, was able to pose or put forward a strategy instead of tactics that had a chance at succeeding. Now, instead, what we were faced with was the poverty activists stuck in their own ghetto, literally and figuratively left at the barricades alone, the public sector unions rebuffing and limping from one attack to another, and the private sector, well, the so-called muscle of the private sector unions, growing weak and flaccid as it waited with crossed fingers for the next election. But since then, the political tide has changed. And I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that OCAP and the rise of the anti-globalization movement has had a key role to play in that change. OCAP's refusal to give up the fight that was started in 1995 and the anti-globalization movement's overwhelming success and ability to bring together so many constituencies and issues fill the streets and actually challenge the viability of the global capitalist agenda. OCAP's call to action is basically this. We call for a massive, coordinated, rank-and-file, street-level activist-led campaign of economic disruption against the Harris government. A campaign that will challenge and attack the unhindered ability of the capitalist class as it basks like a lazy tourist under Harris's favorable rule. We are proposing that we put our moral appeals for mercy away. We are proposing that we forever stop begging from a government that has never once cocked an ear in our direction. And we take on a government that has had one clear agenda all along, to create what is known as a favorable business and profit-making environment. Harris doesn't do protests. And now, brothers and sisters, neither do we. If this government feels like it is appropriate and acceptable to impoverish and attack Ontario's poor and working population, then I say it is more acceptable for Ontario's poor and working population to attack the rich and wealthy if we want to get rid of Harris. Here, here. We must consolidate our forces across sectoral and geographic lines. We must fortify our organizations. We must build our skills. We must stockpile our resources. And with unwavering resolve, launch an attack not yet seen on the bastards that have been raking it in hand over fist while our brothers and sisters have died on the streets of the city. And let me just say that once we start this attack, we cannot stop halfway. We are not in the business of firing warning shots or making empty political threats. If there is one lesson to be learned from the rise of the anti-globalization movement, it is that Harris is only the local attack dog for the global corporate agenda that basically seeks to eradicate every last vestige of public control over society, every last barrier to their ability to make profit. Well, having said that, I want people here to imagine a very real possibility that as our campaign builds and grows and gains momentum, and that as we begin to destabilize Harris's stranglehold over the province, that all the eyes of the world will look to what I like to call the Battle of Ontario and make a choice and actually say, perhaps it is a better strategy to beat back local governments that would put in place international policies of free trade and corporatization rather than protest the high-profile spectacles of international free trade meetings. We are not yet locked into the high-speed collision course with democratic oblivion that the Mike Harrises of the world have put in place for us. OCAP's local struggle against Harris and the anti-globalization struggle against international inequality and injustice have made the bosses take note, albeit in somewhat despicable and deplorable ways, as exemplified by this no-brainer question that The Economist asks. Does inequality matter? I'd like to see them actually go to the people of Akwesasne and ask that question, or the people of the Maquiladoras, the workers in the Maquiladoras. Or the hundreds of homeless people that sleep in the rain at the foot of Queen's Park. Of course, The Economist goes on to say that the rich of today's world are a lot different from the greedy and callous rich of yesterday's world. That in fact, all we have to do is ask them nicely, and they would be more than willing to redistribute some of their wealth. That is, the 400-plus billionaires and the 7 million-plus millionaires of the world. At this point, OCAP has been able to start to build a common front, a united front against Harris. We have more than 200 union locals, anti-globalization formations, student groups, anti-poverty organizations signed on, all with the orientation that our begging days are over. We will not ever stoop to the indignity of begging a single penny from the parasites of this world. Our aim is to drive Mike Harris and his buffoons from office and, at the same time, make the fear of God cross the faces of the world's 400 billionaires and 7 million plus millionaires. Now, if we are serious about the task at hand, we have to ask ourselves and we have to be able to answer some fundamental questions. How do we include and mobilize the maximum number of people? And once mobilized, how do we move from the idea of protest to actual acts of resistance? How do we move beyond the violence, non-violence debate and move to a new level of tactical coordination in our demonstrations and our actions? How do we protect ourselves from state repression? And how do we make the temporary fight against Harris the permanent fight against global capitalism? These are questions that could be easily answered if we are committed to the objective at hand. This province belongs to us. Its streetlights, its roadways, its waterways, its apartment buildings, its highways, the police belong to us. Its public services belong to us. We build its cars and we serve its food. This province is ours. And we go to bed each night not knowing what indignity we'll suffer the next day. If these things are taken away from us, we are the only ones who can take them back. On October the 16th, we will take back the financial district of Toronto. And after October 16th, there will not be one industry in this province that is unaffected by our campaign of economic disruption. Everybody knows what we did to Jim Flaherty last month. Not many people know that a little more than a week afterwards, our allies in the Mohawk Nation of Tiananaga were able to park a school bus in front of the Skyway Bridge and turn away more than 250 transport trucks that shut down the St. Mary's cement factory. And not many people know that the CAW activists in Windsor are planning on setting up a decisive confrontation with the temporary labor agencies down there that are driving down wages. They are in fact going to set up a hiring hall to challenge the predominance of the temporary service agencies and picket and target any business that chooses to hire from low-wage temporary agencies and make them hire from an OCAP-based union hiring hall. As well, Guelph has very good plans. I won't disclose them right now because they may not come to fruition if I say them publicly, but I would say that the Labour Council there had an excellent meeting. Everybody is psyched in Guelph about the campaign. As well, on the campus, and this is a sign of things to come, the faculty members and associations have linked up with the blue-collar workers of the university, have linked up with the students to form a formation to join the campaign. And I told this story once before, and I sort of promised myself I wouldn't, but I think it's important because not everybody here has heard it. And I think it sort of clarifies what's actually been going on in this province and why we actually have to fight back. The other day, or actually last week, a Native woman came to the OCAP office asking for some change so that she can take the streetcar somewhere. I actually didn't have change at the time. She asked me again and persisted and kept asking me, and I told her I didn't. I showed her my wallet. And she said, well, if you don't have any change, do you have a razor blade? And this woman was weather-beaten from years of homelessness and alcoholism. And we, as Harris has taken power and as Harris has implemented these policies that I outlined before, that is happening every day at the OCAP offices. And if we had 10 OCAP offices, that would happen every day at all 10 of our OCAP offices. If we had 100 OCAP offices, that would happen every day at 100 OCAP offices. We have to realize that who we're fighting for. We are fighting for her. We are fighting for the people of Akwesasne. We are fighting for the 100 homeless people sleeping in front of Queen's Park. And if we're going to fight, God damn it, just fucking fight to win, okay? Thanks.
It's becoming a fairly common observation these days that the anti-globalization movement is not linked effectively enough to community-based struggles, and that's a point that Jagi made on Saturday. That's a point that many of us have been talking about in our communities, in our organizations, that a gap exists between the summit-hopping, serial protesting, disruptions of major meetings, of global capitalists and their political allies on the one hand, and the local day-to-day struggles in our communities, in poor communities, in Aboriginal communities, in communities of color on the other hand. So on Saturday, when I was in one of the workshops at the Rebuilding the Left Forum, it was a building labor solidarity across between North and South, I was really surprised and saddened when someone told me that they didn't think that the OCAP fall campaign was relevant to the discussion. But since we are talking about labor solidarity between the North and South, building labor solidarity, that somehow this local campaign in the city of Toronto was not relevant to this discussion, and that it somehow didn't really fit in with the topic at hand. And it seems to me that it's important then to, maybe do a better job of trying to outline the links, making those links between why that fits. We have a situation in communities of color where they are the targets of racist immigration laws and deportations, and yet national and international capital does everything it can to keep wages low, and then turns around and relies on this cheap labor pool to make huge profits for itself, nationally and internationally. There's an estimated 2,000 evictions that happen each month, due to huge cuts in welfare payments, due to deregulation and changes to various acts, legislative acts, all because it is profitable to build condominiums and not affordable housing. So how can we talk of labor solidarity between North and South if we're unwilling and unable to address issues of poverty, of racism, homelessness, low wages in our own city? So I really think it's important to stress that the OCAP Fall campaign of economic and political disruption presents us with a unique opportunity to unite together and fight back in our own communities on a local level, and to link and weave all these local actions and struggles into a wave of protest, into a tapestry of actions, you might say. The Fall OCAP actions can act as a means to focus a mass convergence of workers, of students, of unions, First Nations, global justice activists, feminist organizations, environmental groups, and many other struggles against the Tory government and the corporate interests they serve. So poverty, what I'm trying to say is poverty, low minimum wages, changes to Employment Standards Act, all the litany of woes, to borrow a phrase from John Clark, and as Stefan just pointed out, this litany of woes, this is all the face of capitalist globalization. And both globalization in general and the Tory government and its allies in particular have launched a frontal assault on our communities. So what we see internationally, we're seeing here in our own backyard, and we have to fight it on every level, on several different fronts. You know, Stefan went through a whole bunch of all the ways that all the different aspects of the neoliberal agenda which advances global capitalism. And the struggles against these proposed acts and legislative changes are part of struggles internationally and nationally to resist global capitalism and the race to the bottom. So we need to educate ourselves about struggles that are happening internationally throughout the world, and to make sure that we act on a local level to fight against this assault, this frontal assault on our communities. It would be absolutely irresponsible to give in and let them steamroll us over. During our strike at York University this past fall and winter, we learned that good arguments don't matter a bit. It doesn't matter what you say at the bargaining table. You can have all the good arguments in the world. It's about power. It's about power. We gradually learned that if we didn't stand up to the employer in a very militant way, we would lose everything that we had fought for. It was a strategy that we developed because we had to develop it. Otherwise, we would get toasted. It was born out of the realization that rituals of token protest, symbolic protest, were completely ineffectual, at least at this point in history. So escalate and diversify became the strategy we had to adopt. Our orientation toward our adversary, this had to be one where we, out of necessity, had to disrupt the normal functions of their operations as much as we could, whenever we could. Only by raising the social costs to elites, only by doing this can we get their attention and hope to turn the tide. Raising social costs such that it is easier for elites to give into us than it is to continue fighting us. But militancy can only be sustained if there's genuine rank and file participation and ownership over decision-making processes. Input that has a real effect on the outcome, that one's involvement actually makes a difference. Militancy without rank and file participation, in my case, since I'm part of a union, rank and file union participation, militancy without this union participation won't be able to sustain itself over the long run. So you need both. Well, you need more, but I'll get to that. Rank and file participation is strengthened through solidarity with other organizations. So I'm talking about rank and file participation, militancy, and solidarity. So labor is potentially can potentially be a very radical force. It isn't always, as we know, but it can be. And thus we need to entrench and build in mechanisms which foster and facilitate more dialogue, mutual work, and solidarity between different segments of society, between segments such as the labor movement and the radical anti-capitalist or anti-globalization movement. We're starting to realize that sometimes these movements tend to diverge and aren't always connected in the most in the best and useful way, that we need to connect people up with unions, people who are previously identified little with and are unfamiliar with working class politics, connect them up to what unions are doing, the history of unions, get them involved, get them participating. This situation is also coupled with another situation whereby labor activists are not coming into contact with anti-capitalist ideas as much as they could and should, and more militant forms of direct action, which is not helped at all by the fact that some unions, many unions, tend to operate in a bureaucratic top-down fashion and therefore encourages passive forms of resistance rather than active and militant forms of resistance. I think it's important that the labor movement not pass judgments and try not to be hypocritical. We need to work together. Whatever arguments and issues we might want to take up within our organizations, do not publicly condemn other organizations and other tactics. We need to be tolerant. We need to be mutually respectful.
Then why exclude the Trotskyists?
Well, maybe we can get to that later. But in the meantime,
Adam, you'll have a chance in the discussion.
We need to be tolerant, mutually respectful. Don't police our own members. I think that's really important. We need to try to foster as much as possible an anti-capitalist analysis, an internationalist analysis. Try to foster ways of doing anti-racist work and building in an anti-racist feminist analysis. Reorient union activity away from a preoccupation with servicing its members and emphasizing organizing its members. Once you get something in terms of bargaining, bargain for something and get it, it's absolutely imperative to socialize it. What I mean by that is share it. The only way to keep it is to pass it on to others and thus narrow the gap between what you're able to get and what others have at the moment. Unions are lucky to have financial resources at their disposal, so they need to use those to help build solidarity, make the links between organizations. Flying squads are essential here. I believe that they're a wonderful mechanism which facilitates member participation, which facilitates solidarity, militant forms of action. Strikes are one kind of direct action that flying squads can help with. Other types of actions are helping out with like stopping deportations, stopping evictions, that kind of thing and so forth. All these are ways of countering passivity that has arisen due to the sense that there is no alternative, that our collective participation can make a difference, but we need to work together to make that happen. And flying squads, a group of people who get together to disrupt the normal operations of a workplace or disrupt the normal operations of a company or of an international institution, economic institution, we need to foster building those in our organizations, and we're seeing them sprout up all over the place. And I think they're a wonderful thing because in many ways they can build, like I said, militancy, rank-and-file participation, solidarity. It was great to be at a CUPE Ontario convention a month or so ago and hear some comments made by the president, national president of CUPE Ontario. She argued for taking the struggle to a whole new level, to go on the offensive like never before, mobilize the broadest coalitions, engage in civil disobedience and direct action. And this was very inspiring to hear that finally a broad labor movement who has been somewhat passive, but not always passive, but somewhat passive, is starting to wake up and go on the frontal assault ourselves. So I think it's important to build on the momentum created thus far that's building in this province, draw on the revitalized and renewed energy of resistance, and direct it towards launching just the kind of disruptive campaign and popular mobilization that offers a chance to turn the tide in this province. Thanks.
I want to use my time on the panel to make some links between the so-called anti-globalization or anti-corporate movement, what we saw in Quebec City and Seattle and Windsor, what we're going to see in Genoa and Italy against the G8, and OCAP's upcoming economic disruption campaign. I'm going to be making some links, but while I do so, I think the basics are quite clear. Clarice and Stefan have touched on them. Those basics are community-based organizing that's based in our neighborhoods. We have to get beyond ritual and symbolism, and the idea that power can't be charmed or persuaded into changing. It must be disrupted, it must be confronted head on. I mean, those are the basics, but I want to sort of apply those basics to this link, or make a link between the anti-globalization, so-called anti-globalization movement and the upcoming disruption campaign. To do so, I guess what I want to do is maybe evaluate very quickly these large-scale mobilizations. On one level, as Stefan was pointing out, they're really positive. People who've attended these large-scale protests have come away very empowered. They've become very very important, empowering collective experiences. They've opened up a sense of possibility. People are asking some very basic questions about how we organize and what do we want. It's forced people to confront and reckon with a more complex understanding of the world and getting beyond this idea that we're against bad things and we're for good things. We have to start naming names and getting very specific about what we oppose and what we want. And that kind of complex understanding happens in the course of struggle. And I think tactically, street actions, disruptions, these shutdowns, the tactics that are happening on the ground are a clear break with prevailing authority, with a prevailing consensus of lobbying these institutions, which again is a good thing. And I think we've seen a crisis of legitimacy of a variety of institutions like the WTO or the World Bank, and as well a crisis of functioning. They have to start running away and meet at places like Qatar, which is where the next World Trade Organization meeting is going to be held. The next G8 meeting is supposed to be held in Ottawa, but the Quebecian government is seriously considering moving it to a ski resort, either Banff or Whistler or Jasper, so much more easier to cut off protesters. The Montreal Gazette even went so far as to write an editorial saying, why don't we have these conferences meet by video conference, and that way you don't have to deal with protest. And another thing about this anti-globalization movement is it's been sustained. We can now evaluate it, I guess, 2 years after Seattle, and it's been sustained, almost farcically so, where any time corporate elites, various trade accords try to be negotiated, there's a massive confrontation. Even in Whistler this summer, so July in Whistler, there are people going to be confronting a local regional economic bloc, which is quite impressive. But all is not well. It's never been well.
I think there are critiques and problems to be underlined. I have a lot of them, but I guess the one I want to touch on today is the disjunction, the gap between sites of struggle, sites of resistance, day-to-day resistance, like in Aboriginal communities, in communities of color, in poor communities, a gap between that and these large-scale protests. That is, these large-scale protests lack a link to community resistance. This has been expressed quite nicely by a thinker in the United States called Jay Sakai, and he said this, and he was referring to his context, which is New York City. He wrote the following: was it the WTO which placed a major sewage treatment plant right in Harlem, knowingly pushing up air pollution levels just as an epidemic of black and Latin childhood asthma was starting? No, that criminal act was committed by our very own local capitalism. But for New York City anti-WTO protesters, it might be that Seattle is much closer than Harlem, if you know what I mean. And I guess we can ask the same questions. For a lot of anti-FTAA or anti-WTO protesters in Toronto, Quebec City or Seattle is a whole lot closer than, say, Regent Park or Akwesasne or Walkerton, if you know what I mean. So I think that's the gap that has to be addressed, and that's a very real gap that exists. Sakai goes on to state, was it the WTO that has killed and is killing thousands of Navajos by radioactive uranium ore waste poisoning? No, that was the so-called democratic U.S. government. Is it the WTO or the FTAA, which is perpetuating genocide against Native peoples in Canada for 200, 300, 400 years? No, that's our very own democratic Ontario and Canadian governments. So while these summits are being chased to Qatar or to Banff, if people want to go there, and while I think there's a crisis of legitimacy and a crisis of functioning, the fact is capitalism is alive and well, as alive and well as it's ever been, despite these large-scale mobilizations. And I think what we're doing is maybe losing, to use a metaphor, losing the forest from the trees. One aspect of globalization that is quite often underlined and targeted is the so-called structural adjustment program, SAPs, that the IMF and World Bank imposes on a variety of countries. What are structural adjustment programs? Well, they are cuts to subsidies, to fuel, and to food in a variety of countries, the privatization of wide areas of wide sectors of government, cuts to social spending, creating competitive practices by ensuring flexible labor or getting rid of a variety of standards. Those are structural adjustment programs. These are imposed on countries such as Indonesia or Mexico. Well, Ontario has had its very own structural adjustment program, but unlike the other structural adjustment programs, they're not enforced. They're voluntarily undertaken by our governments. Our structural adjustment program is called the Common Sense Revolution, and it does exactly the same thing. Now, sociologists have attributed a certain phenomena, or have underlined a certain phenomena called the IMF riot. These were very common in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. That is, when these kinds of massive cuts to social programs, when this kind of misery is created in order to ensure a competitive environment, people react, people riot. And there were widespread IMF riots in the 80s and the 70s. And in many ways, these riots were understood and respected by people observing them, because they understood that that's what happens when you do this to people. I think in Ontario, we had our very own little IMF riot last June 15th. And it was justified. And it was a reaction to these kind of cuts. And I think when anti-globalization activists or observers are looking at what's happening in the South, in Indonesia and Mexico, and people reacting to these kind of cutbacks, I think we should start using that kind of analysis here in terms of what Harris is doing here. So what are some lessons that we have to learn? Well, we have to start naming names and taking down addresses and being very specific about what we're opposing, get away from the abstract. So what are the names? Well, we have Harris and Flaherty and Clements, Sabucci, Stockwell, Fantino, Lastman, Frank Stronach. You can go on and on and on. And I'm sure we can do a brainstorming of who these names are and who are these people implementing this agenda. You want to name a name? Yeah? Who? Kretchen, sure. I was sticking to Ontario. In terms of naming addresses, well, the Stock Exchange, Anderson Consulting's offices, Queen's Park, and I know people here can go on and on about what those things are and what those addresses are. So there are sites of struggle. They're in our neighborhoods, they're on reserves, they're in factories, they're in schools, they're in the streets. And people in the anti-globalization movement have talked about bridging this gap. Well, bridging this gap is not about getting people involved in those sites of struggle to come to Quebec or to go to Washington or to go to New York City for a Wall Street action. It's for people involved in those movements to act in a spirit of respect and solidarity with those struggles that already exist. Those sites of struggle exist, and those sites of struggle are against globalization. The common sense revolution is all about capitalist globalization. Another lesson, this is something that Clarice was referring to, is that we shouldn't shy away from radical ideas and radical politics, that they provide a reference point from which people can respond to and act with. In Quebec City, for example, it wasn't considered a mainstream idea to try to disrupt the summit or to attack the fence or to talk about anti-capitalism and to say it's a waste of time to try to even sit down with these ministers and discuss what kind of FTAA we want. And while that was not a mainstream idea, it did gain grudgingly the respect of a lot of rank-and-file unionists and a lot of common people. And I don't think we should shy away from that. That means having a clear radical analysis, and that means talking about respecting diverse ways of opposition, diverse ways of responding to this agenda, what we called in the CLAC a respect for diversity of tactics. I think the fact that these conferences, these large world conferences like the WTO or the G8 are moving to places like Qatar or Banff, that is, places that aren't easily accessible to us, are a blessing in disguise, or actually just a blessing, period. They force us to be really strategic and to think about those things that we always are supposed to think about, like long-term goals and local organizing. And what does that mean if you're sitting in Toronto or in Montreal? Well, we have to raise the social costs. That's what economic disruption is all about. When it's in our community, it's no longer symbolic anymore. It's tangible. It's real. It's about what's happening around us. In CLAC, we were evaluating our campaign against in Quebec City, and we were saying, so what are we beyond opposing a summit? Well, we talked about those issues that we were trying to address, like social housing. There's a crisis now of housing in Montreal. On July 1st, a lot of people move out, and there are literally hundreds and hundreds of families that had nowhere to move to because housing prices are being raised, and a lot of the housing that is available is just substandard. You couldn't live there. We talked about support for immigrants and refugees, particularly Melka Salvador, a Filipina nanny, a domestic worker who was under threat of deportation. We talked about campaigns around police brutality, campaigns around public spaces. That is tangible reality to us locally. And yes, CLAC has come out and supported OCAP's economic disruption campaign, even though the last time I checked, Montreal wasn't in Ontario. You might recall there was a slogan during the last referendum, the Charlottetown referendum, which was my Canada includes Quebec. Well, for the time being, my Quebec includes Ontario. When I was in Vancouver, a lot of people felt that way as well, because the battle here is felt all over Canada. In many ways, Harris is the avant-garde of imposing a very specific type of capitalist globalization. And there's absolutely no contradiction of Montrealers and people in Vancouver and elsewhere coming out in support of this campaign. I guess I want to end with an anecdote about Quebec City, and I'm not going to talk about April 2001, but actually a whole month before. Sean from OCAP likes to say that the action is in the organizing. That is, it's not so much what happens that day, October 16th or April 20th or whatever day you want to pick, where there's been a large-scale mobilization. It's building up to that, and the links you're making and the consciousness you're creating. And that really came home to me a month before when I was here in Toronto and I attended an event by the Mobilization for Global Justice. Actually, it wasn't an event. It was more of a logistics meeting. To get ready for Quebec City. And I was astounded by the level of organizing that was going on. I'm not sure how many buses went eventually, but the amount of people involved, it was almost like a military operation. And it was really impressive, and it was a great thing. But I thought to myself, what if that energy, those resources, that level of organization was applied here? $1,000 or $2,000 to pay for a bus to Quebec City is one thing. $1,000 or $2,000 invested in a local struggle, which has just as much impact and is just as meaningful to people worldwide, I'd say. What if that was to happen? And I guess it's with that that I'll end. I think that's a challenge before us. Again, to go back to the basics, it's about being in our community. It's about getting beyond ritual and symbolism. It's about realizing that power can't be charmed or persuaded into changing. And as Stefan said, it's about fighting to win. Thank you.